Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thanks for downloading Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4. In this programme, I talk to Ray Davies.
Welcome to Master Tapes. That's the sound of Ray Davies playing the intro to the Kinks classic Lola for our audience here at the BBC's Maida Vale studios. In this edition, I'll be taking Ray back to 1970 and 71 and the making of two albums which together represented a pivotal point in his songwriting career and the music of his band, the Kinks. We'll be discussing the albums Lola versus Power Man and The Money Go Round Part 1 and its follow-up, Muswell Hill Billy.
But I don't wanna be him. You've come a long way from the runny-nosed and scruffy kid I knew.
Ray Davies, welcome to Master Tapes. We're going back over 40 years to the making of these two records, and they were both, to an extent, concept albums in that they both dealt with themes. And firstly, the Lola album, that was very much about the music biz and corruption, wasn't it?
Concept albums is an overused term. I think they're thematic albums. You could say Frank Sinatra did the first concept album, Come Fly With Me. Everything was about flying and getting high. They were conceptualised pieces, yeah, thinking about it.
But the Lola album was very much about corruption, was it? You were fed up with the music business at that point?
I wasn't fed up with it. It was, subconsciously, it became a diary, a musical diary of my life, my adventures. I think the music business has always been corrupt. Like most businesses where young people get involved, my brother, Dave Davies, was 15 when we signed our first recording agreement. We weren't protected. And it goes right back to the blues men in America in the 40s and 50s who were signed up to these ridiculous deals and they had no rights to their music. Yeah. Everybody else owned their rights. So it was driven by the situation surrounding us very much so. And I was playing some of the tracks this morning and reading the lyrics. The lyrics were power in those days. It doesn't mean so much to be a good lyricist these days, I somehow think. It's more about rhythmic quality. But it gave people like me, working-class North Londoner, working-class Liverpudlians like the Beatles, it gave people a voice, and it was a way of voicing my opinions.
And the second album that we're talking about today, Muswell Hillbillies, I mean, that was broadly about the pressures of 20th-century life and urban development, wasn't it? Muswell Hill, you were brought up in Muswell Hill, but in fact your family had moved up from Islington.
Well, we made the giant leap of 3-4 miles. My family were sort of based around Holloway and Camden. My mother was born in Barnsbury, and it sounds like a really posh address, but it was a slum when she lived there. She decided when she had the family, I come from this large family, all girls before me, not including my brother, of course, she decided to make the move up to Finchley, Muswell Hill, north of all the... There was a lot of poverty in London at that point. So she made that decision. And I grew up in that area, in the sort of more refined area, as it was, apparently.
And so much of your songwriting has been influenced and directly addresses life in the English, well, the North London suburbs specifically. Do you ever wonder what would have happened to your writing, how the writing would have panned out if the family had stayed in the more urban environment of Islington?
What amazed me is a lot of my contemporaries, they write songs about growing up in New Orleans or, yeah. or you know, Cleveland. All my first Kinks hits, I think, could have been written within 100 yards radius of where I grew up. They were about the characters, the things that went on in people's lives, and the events that took place surrounding where I grew up. So my only life experience was growing up in North London, and that's all I knew. I couldn't sing about Mississippi because I hadn't been there. I admired the music. I admired people like Big Bill Brunsey and John Lee Hooker because I heard the music. Amazingly, for younger listeners, there were two stations. There was a light program, which was like radio everything. And there was a home service that was more like Radio 4. So you had two choices, music or no music, if you were young. And there was a wonderful program on called Jazz Club. And my first blues music I heard was on Jazz Club. And it was, I think, 2 hours a week.
Well, this is inconceivable for a young generation who are brought up on the instant download service. Anything you want to hear, you can just get it within seconds.
And well, that's
you,
it.
You have to wait for days to hear a great song when you were growing up.
Also, the other key thing was this thing called, I shouldn't say, but Radio Luxembourg, which was...
It's all right, they're not competitors anymore, Ray.
Well, they should be. Radio Luxembourg, I heard my first sort of hardcore R&B on that.
And let's get a sense of what had led up to these two albums that we're talking about in this programme. Because by 1970, you were a massive star in Britain, weren't you? And had been for 5 or 6 years, but always a reluctant celebrity.
Yeah, and that's very simple. I didn't intend to be the front man, I just wrote the song. My brother, Dave, is prettier, more talented musically on the guitar anyway. He's a great guitar player, an innovative player. And I've still got the same gap in my teeth I had then. And I remember my first TV show. I heard the director say, cut away from the guy singing because he's got bad teeth. So I'm not really the most visually viable commodity. That's why I was a reluctant frontman.
But the thing is, you had the songs and you had You Really Got Me and All Day and All the Night and all of those initial R&B influenced songs. And that sense of world weariness that developed on after that initial run of singles, when you really found your voice as a writer, and you know, when you're writing Sunny Afternoon and Waterloo Sunset, the melancholy and the romance, that was always there, really, wasn't it? I mean, where does that come from, do you think? Is that just innate?
No, I think melancholy is part of our culture. We're an island race. And melancholy is part of our culture. All the great poets have that wistfulness. It's because we've become Americanized, we watch too much American TV, that we're afraid to be melancholy. And also my grounding, as I said, I come from this large family, and all the girls, older sisters, brought home their big band music. And my father liked a man called Al Boley, who sang so sweetly in a much higher frequency. And it kind of impose a sense of melancholy, a lot of the melodies. I think the generation that my parents were from, and my sisters particularly, were not afraid to be schmaltzy.
And you had been, the Kinks, having toured in America in the mid-60s, and there was a dispute with the American Musicians Union, and while the Stones and the Beatles and the Who were becoming big stars in the States, you literally couldn't get into the country, and then I guess, what, you turned your songwriter's eye to your own backyard.
And also, the Kinks symbolised everything that was British because I sang in an English accent. It really got me, well-respected man.
And you'd examined English life on those singles that I mentioned, but also on the Village Green Preservation Society album, where you're talking about very much, it's about nostalgia, it's about it, there's a yearning for the old days. But then with the Lola album, Lola versus Power Man and the Money Go Round Part 1, it's a journey through the music business. We look at the opening track, The Contenders, about the young hopefuls, and then you address the publishers who are working in the song Denmark Street, and then you're talking about the unions in Get Back in Line, and then there's a promotional circuit and the razzmatazz on the song Top of the Pops, and then the accountants are addressed on Money Go Round.
You know, the Kinks just didn't offend some people. They offended everybody.
Well, I was going to say, you were biting the hand that fed you, weren't you?
No, we weren't. The hand that took you... It was one bad deal after another. And when you get in that position of weakness, it was the establishment, the then music establishment was based on old-time agency power and old record industry ethos. We were treated as young people who wanted to change the industry. We wanted to help the industry. It literally went from one bad catastrophe to another.
You were ripped off then, were you?
Yes, of course. In the song Top of the Pops on Lola versus Power Man, there's a line, it might turn into a steady job. It wasn't considered to be a steady job. Now you can have a career at being a musician. Well, we couldn't have that. We were groundbreakers.
And you say you were trying to change things. Was the album written very much as a warning to other bands then? Or was it cathartic? Did it feel better having written about these people who were ripping you off?
I think it was common knowledge what was happening, but nobody really wrote about it or sung about it before. It goes back to the great black folk music, you know, Pick a Bale of Cotton. There's a great song by Brunsey, if you're white, it's all right, but if you're black, get back, get back, get back. It was drawing on the inspiration of that sort of music.
And can you remember the way that the album came together lyrically? Did you sit down and think, I am going to address this subject, I'm going to write an album about the music business, or did the songs emerge all following the same theme?
It's really simple. I have a dispute with somebody, dedicated follower of fashion, not connected with this record. It was written after I had a quarrel with a leading designer. He said, your flares are too wide. It was a fight about drain pipes and flares. It was handbags. But at the end of it, I said, I can get you. I'll write a song about it. And dedicated follower of fashion was written out of anger. It ended up being quite a jovial song. But it was my way of getting back. It's the only ammunition I had to actually fight back with. I'll write a song about it.
So the real people do populate these albums then. And let's start with part of a title track, Lola. Not the Power Man or the Money Go Around, but the character of Lola. I mean, it's a story that you've told many times before, but I mean, that was based on a real situation. It wasn't you picking up a transvestite, it was a manager, wasn't it?
I still don't know for sure whether it was a transvestite or a transsexual.
Ah.
But it's inspired by an incident in a bar in Paris, a very fashionable club. You know, the evil part about being a songwriter and being the quiet one is you coax other people into doing things. You just wanted to notate and take note of the incident. And it was my manager, and he said, Ray, it looks like a woman. I said, well, it is a woman. Go and ask her to dance. And I knew it was a transvestite. But I just wanted to see the reaction to it. And so I was more like a reporter than a songwriter.
And the songwriting process when you were making these albums, and Lola in particular, how far were you developing the songs before you took them into the studio and offering them to the band? Are they pretty well worked up, fully formed in your head?
I think Lola came late, the song Lola came late. I had the story I wanted to project. I had most of the album written. I said, now I need a hit that everybody can sort of gravitate towards a record and the album. And Lola came quite late. The first phrase was really, I had a one-year-old daughter at the time. It was simply something for her to sing to, la, 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 la. That's how the song started.
Really?
Yeah, and then I put in all the transvestite stuff.
Right. And with Lola, would it always start with the lyrics? Would the lyrics be complete before you start building the chords around it?
And would Not when I sang it to my daughter. I didn't say I met her in a club down in Old Soho. But I knew what I wanted to, particularly with that song. I wanted it to connect with people, but not say something trite. I've never written love songs. I'm not very good at them. I write about love, but not I love you, baby, come back to my place, you know, it'll be a fine romance. That's not my style. And we recorded I'm Not the World's Most Passionate Guy, but I'm a guy, whatever I am, and so is Lola. And by this time, after Dedicated Follower of Fashion, I was regarded in sort of society set of music industry as having a certain edge to my writing. So it's to fulfil a requirement as well, to give it some edge.
Well, so the bar had been raised quite high, and then there was an expectation that you would always have that lyrical twist in there. There would be a barb in the lyric then.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I didn't sing the lyrics to the band while they were rehearsing because I wanted them to play. The whole thing about it is kind of a macho swing to it. It got a stride to it, but it's sort of questionable subject matter. And Avery, the drummer, if you told him it was a camp, he would have done all these funny little bell rings and things. So keep the content away from musicians. It's a good tip.
They had no idea about what you would be singing about.
They knew the chorus, Lola, Lola, Lola.
Right.
Then we finished the record, and the record company said, it's great, we're putting it out. Something bothered me about it. It started with a little arpeggio guitar. I said, it's got to be a hit in the first 3 seconds. And we still didn't have that. At the end of the verse, there's a phrase, C, 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 D, E. And so I said, how can I make this work with the sound? So I went back in the studio, got the engineer to run the tape, and I played that phrase, C, 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 D, D, E. See, that wasn't on the original record.
Right.
That sounds like a hit. Not because Lola's been a hit, but it gets your attention.
Yeah.
Like, you really got me, had an attention-grabbing moment. You know, writing songs is like chatting up somebody if you want a date. You grabbed their attention.
That's your opening line, that.
Keep them occupied for 2 minutes and get out of there, or fade out. So that's what became the intro.
And just taking you back to the title of the album, Lola versus Power Man and the Money Go Round, part one. What happened to part two?
There was a follow-up to be planned, but we got carried away on going back to America and touring.
So instead of making Lola part two, you moved on to the next album, another thematic album, Muswell Hillbillies. And in a way, this is a very worried look at the world from behind neck curtains in a suburban semi, isn't it? It's...
Did you think of that? It's a pretty good description.
Well, it's your worldview, isn't it?
You know what? What it is, it's significant in the sense that we were just being allowed to tour America. And when you think that the first time we went to America, we played auditoriums holding 20,000 people. We topped the Hollywood Bowl, supported by the Beach Boys, the Righteous Brothers and the Byrds, Sonny and Cher. All those people went on before us. We've gone from that to not being able to get books, selling out a small club in Manhattan. So it was a conscious attempt to give ourselves a new image. The way I did that, I reverted to my Holloway roots, which was, by this time, early 70s, was being redeveloped. It was urban renewal. They were knocking down lots of houses and making those cultures move out. So it was about the birth and the death of a culture. And the album sleeve itself, Muswell Hillbillies, is taken inside the Archway Tavern pub.
And that, on the inside of the gatefold, we've just got the album here, and this is now a concrete council estate, and these streets, these...
I went down there, I drove one of my sisters down there to see where she grew up. She said, the houses have gone, but they've replaced it with modern equivalents. They're not any grander.
But what's interesting is looking at the world, looking at this urban and suburban change, but the musical backdrop is more American than on any of your other records, unless you regard You Really Got Me and All Day and All of the Night as English versions of American R&B, because, I mean, you've got the blues and you've got country and you've got bluegrass. Was there pressure from the record company to appeal directly to an American audience, or was that just where, again, your instinct was taking you?
That's where I was going, and... The key deal point with RCA was that they have no creative input. That was vital to me.
Did you ban them from the studio?
No, they were welcome to come as long as they didn't interfere. And we reinvented ourselves as the Muswell Hillbillies.
And the very opening line of the album sets the tone, I think, lyrically. This is the age of machinery, a mechanical nightmare, the wonderful world of technology, napalm, hydrogen bombs, biological warfare. This is the 20th century. Good job the record company weren't going to get involved, because that's not the sort of lyric they wanted to hear on a Kinks record, I presume.
Yeah, a bit of a way from a dedicated follower of fashion. But again, we were growing up. I'm trying to think how old I was when I made that record. I was 24, 25.
Yeah.
But I was an old man by then. And also, while we were banned from America, the Vietnam War was escalating. There was social upheaval. Martin Luther King had been killed. America was changing. And even though I was still living in North London, my world was changing. So my anger reflected that.
Well, I was going to say, it is an angry record, this one, isn't it? There's a lot of paranoia and despair lyrically throughout. I mean, the second track's called Acute Schizophrenia Paranoia Blues.
Yeah, it's great.
Here Come the People in Grey, that's another track. And that's a song which directly addresses or attacks what the local councils were doing to the streets around you.
I got a letter this morning with some serious news that's gonna ruin my day. The borough surveyors and a compulsory purchase that's ruined my day. They're gonna dig up the floors, they're gonna knock down the walls, they're gonna dig up the drain. Here come the people in grey, they're gonna take me away to Lord knows only where. But I'm so unprepared, I got no clothes to act and I got nothing to wear. It's after 25 years. Here come the people in grey to take me away. That sort of thing. It's sung.
When was the last time you sang that song, do you think?
We never did it live. I don't know, just after we recorded it.
What, you mean you never did it live as the Kinks?
No.
So that's possibly the first time you've performed it on a stage then, is it?
Yeah, it's a world premiere.
Well, that's
how about that? Well,
but the remarkable thing is, and you haven't been playing that with Bill, that was totally unrehearsed, you put your guitarist on the spot there, but you remembered all of those lyrics. So they are hardwired in there.
I missed a few.
Did you?
got a couple of conduct marks.
Are all the lyrics there? If I just threw a song at you, would at least the root line of the lyric, would it be there? Would it come out?
You can try. I can't promise anything.
Well, let's talk about the title track, Muswell Hillbillies, which closes the album. There are references there to people being put in little boxes, no character, uniformity. And again, you're writing about what is depicted there on the album sleeve, those houses that are about to be demolished and replaced. And contrast that to a song, I guess, like Shangri-La from only 2 or 3 years earlier. A very romantic vision of the Englishman in his castle. It's a wistful and romantic song, that. But this, again, is a far angrier lyric, isn't it?
It's got some humour to it. There's a wry smile to it. Well, I said goodbye to Rosie. Can I say one thing? Rosie Rooke really existed.
Who's the character in the song?
Rosie Rooke was my mother's best friend, and this is a personal statement. They were walking around the market near Holloway when Rosie Rooke and my mother were probably about 15. My father picked up a bundle of horse manure and threw it at Rosie Rooke and knocked her hat off.
Why?
I don't know, it's a way of chatting her up, I think.
Oh, really? All right. But she was a real character. There's another character that populates your
song. Yeah, as was Uncle Son, who was my Uncle Sonny, who worked the railroad.
Uncle Son, that's the song that precedes this one on the album.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the penultimate
song.
How
analytical,
on the album.
Or should I say anal retentive?
That's the nature of the programme, I'm afraid, Ray.
Well, I said goodbye to Rosie Rook this morning. I'm gonna miss her bloodshot alcoholic eyes. She wore her Sunday hat so she'd impress me. Hat reference. I'm gonna carry that memory till the day I die. They'll move me up to Muswell Hill tomorrow. Photographs and souvenirs are all I've got. They're gonna try and make me change my way of living, but they'll never make me something that I'm not. Chorus. I'm a Muswell.
And throughout the album, there is this tension between the Englishness of the lyrics and the American setting, almost. And I'm a Muswell hillbilly, but my heart lies in old West Virginia. Did it make inroads in America? Did it work musically? How well did it sell in the States?
It did good, and we survived reissue after reissue. But then we made the problem with the Kinks, the problem with me is that I'll do one great album in a certain style, the next one I'll do a completely different. It's like a different person. If I'm not entertained by what I do, I can't make other people entertained or like it. So we embarked on a series of strange albums. But the Muswell Hillbillies, we found an audience, certainly.
Yeah. And did you regard these two albums as companion pieces? We've been talking about Lola and Muswell Hillbillies. Very different sounding albums, but are they two sides of the same coin, do you think?
One is a departure and the reason you're leaving an environment, a situation. And the other one is creating a new image, but taking joy and pride in where your origins are. Mm.
And let me ask you about the song, one of my favourite songs on the Lola album, This Time Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's a song that has a great sense of freedom in it. I mean, lyrically, the protagonist is there in an aeroplane. And this coincides, I guess, with the Kinks going back to America for the first time. So lyrically, that's what you were tapping into there, was it?
It's quite a stream of consciousness, a song. I had an editorial device. I never wrote anything down. In those days, I just sang it. I had probably the key line, the kickoff line, and then if I couldn't remember it, it couldn't be good. So
really? So you never carried notebooks around?
Until I got into the studio. It's only that period. Maybe I lost my notepad or something. I notated You Really Got Me. I remember that because we didn't have a tape recorder. The only way to remember it is to remember. I wrote it down. But I never wrote lyrics down until we got into the studio. Then I'd write them down so we had reference with the engineers, and if we did another take, I could recapture the lyric and repeat it.
Yeah. And there's a lovely thing that happens in This Time Tomorrow. I mean, you're playing in a major chord, but then it goes to an A minor on that line about, I'll leave the sun behind me and watch the clouds as they sadly pass me by. I mean, it's such a lovely image, and that goes to an A minor there, so that it undercuts the sense
of
space.
I did that track with Mumford & Sons a few years ago, and the bass player said to me, can you have less chords? It's hurting my hands. Because he has an upright bass player. I was writing the way I spoke, and I do that a lot with my songs. I throw the odd two beats in at the end of a bar or phrase. Yeah.
Again, to keep yourself interested.
Also, to stop it becoming repetitive. Again, the way you read it. Say it again.
I'll leave the sun behind me and watch the clouds as they sadly pass me by.
Incorrectly performed, but the feeling was right.
Yeah, it was. That was like Peter Sellers as Olivier doing Hard Day's Night, in fact, wasn't it?
No.
I'm going to leave it to you to do. Because
I pass me by. It's where you put the stress.
Exactly. It's all the stress.
Yeah. And on that song, that line came simultaneously with the chords.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear how it panned out. I'd like you to play us out of this part of the programme with a live version of This Time Tomorrow. There's a lot more to talk about. And in the second part of this edition, the B-side, our studio audience will be posing the questions. You can hear that next Monday night at 11 o'clock. But for now, my thanks to Ray Davies. And as Ray gets ready to play us out, there's just time to remind you of the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, where you can download this programme and the rest of the series, and you can hear exclusive full versions of some of the songs we've been discussing, including this one, This Time Tomorrow, Ray Davies.
This time tomorrow, where will we be? On a spaceship somewhere, sailing across an empty sea.
And if you want to hear more material recorded at this Master Tape session, including exclusive performances, photographs and videos, go to the Master Tapes pages via the Radio 4 website.